Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome tonight. We're about to have a conversation with Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges, of course, written the book The World As It Is, The Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, American Fascists, many other books. He was an award-winning, won a Pulitzer Prize for collective coverage of global terrorism for the New York Times. He covered wars throughout the globe and has been writing a great deal over the last several years now just about the state of our society, where capitalism is, what is happening to us, and trying to make us all wake up a little bit, a little shake by the bells conversation for America. And Chris Hedges, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow.org, and we will take your questions. steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, and we'll look to see what you have to say there. 410-319-8888 is the number. So let's start off with where you were this morning. This morning you were testifying, right?
Friday.
Friday morning.
I did a deposition in New York, built around the lawsuit that I have filed against Barack Obama and Leon Panetta over the National Defense Authorization Act. And we will go to court at 9 a.m. In Manhattan on Thursday if I am considered a credible plaintiff or a plaintiff withstanding, then the lawyers will file an injunction, temporary injunction, to hold in abeyance this law, which, of course, the government will immediately challenge.
Of course. No, let's go backwards a minute. We need to talk about what the NDAA law is, what this Homeland Battlefield bill really is, and why you, and it was you and you others, Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, a parliamentarian from Iceland, and others, did this together.
Yeah, I started it, and then they joined me. It's a terrifying piece of legislation, and it's not very long. The most important sections, 1021 and 1022, it permits the executive branch to strip U.S. citizens of due process, to authorize the military to detain them, hold them indefinitely, until, in the language of the bill, the end of hostilities. Including in our offshore black sites or offshore penal colonies. It broadens the definition of what constitutes a terrorist or a terrorist collaborator from the Authorization to Use Military Force Act of 2001, which was very specifically aimed at al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Now it's this nebulous term, associated forces. People who are deemed to have, this is the language of the bill, provided substantial support can be picked up. And it is absolutely catastrophic assault against basic civil liberties. I mean, it went into effect at the beginning of this month, and I think essentially means that we are no longer a constitutional democracy. If by constitutional democracy you mean a governing system where everybody has access to the courts and to legal redress.
So what do you think it means, associated groups? What do you think that would – what would that portend for, whether it's you as a journalist, me as a talk show host, Cassandra Monsanto as a producer going out there to do the work they do? What does it mean could happen, and how could that happen?
Well, I think that's what's so frightening, because these terms are so nebulous. What does it mean substantially? What does it mean supported? What does it mean associated groups? You know, how are these defined?
So does that mean, for argument's sake, I go interview Hamas and do a story on Hamas and put that out there, even though the United States says, no, we shouldn't be talking to Hamas. Does that mean that we're then liable to be detained and arrested, from your perspective?
Yes. I mean, there's no exemption for journalists. And as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East, I was frequently with both individuals and groups that are on the U.S. State Department list, including, of course, not only Hamas, but the leaders of Hamas, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which I covered in southeastern Turkey. Islamic Jihad, the Jamaat Islamiyah in Algeria, the Salafis in Egypt. These were all groups that I had very close contact with. And when you are writing articles that counter the official narrative, especially when the U.S. is invested in a particular conflict, they always go after the press. That was something I experienced as a reporter in Central America in the early 1980s during the Reagan administration. They set up run by a guy named Raymond, a former CIA propagandist, a whole unit to shape public opinion about the Contra, U.S.-backed Contra forces in Nicaragua, as well as the war in El Salvador. But more importantly, to aggressively discredit reporters who were not compliant as being communist or communist sympathizers. Some of those figures, Elliot Abrams, Oliver North, were eventually convicted for lying to Congress and for felonies. But I think for those of us who were involved in those battles in the early 80s, it's very frightening to think that this kind of power would have been at their disposal because they would have used it.
And what would that have meant to use it, do you think?
Well, it would
have. If it was a law then.
Well, if it was a law then, given the rhetoric that they were employing to describe us, there was no differentiation between us and the FMLN, Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front rebels in El Salvador, or the leftist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. They didn't make those distinctions. We were propagandist fellow travelers. I mean, the language was fierce, and because the atrocities that were being committed by the Salvadoran military, as well as by the Contra-backed forces, were so egregious, there was a concerted effort to essentially cover up what these groups were doing and who they were, because, of course, they were backed by the U.S. government. So for reporters who went out and wrote about massacres and wrote about the kinds of killings and rapes and assaults that these groups were engaged in, or wrote about the death squads in El Salvador, they were an impediment to that narrative. And there weren't many of us. I mean, we're talking probably about maybe a couple dozen who were based there and reporting day in and day out. So we could have been, I think, under this type of legislation, easily removed, physically removed.
And beyond journalists and reporters, I mean, I'm thinking about the dozens of cases that, and the numbers of cases we probably covered on this show, of many Arab Americans and others who were associated with some group in the Middle East that they say is a charity to take care of children, but this government says no, it's a front for whatever organization we deem a terrorist organization, and they've been put on trial and some have been put in prison.
Well, that's right? A very important example, because what happens is that this type of legislation, this ability to strip citizens of basic legal protection, is always done against a demonized marginal group. And you're right, Muslim Americans have been the target. We've seen it with whether it's Dr. Samuel Arian or Fahad Hashmi and others. And so, you know, this assault against basic civil liberties is always carried out in the name of national security. They use fear to essentially abrogate for themselves power that in normal times nobody would ever let the state have. So yes, you're exactly right that the but you know the legislation is ostensibly passed to I mean look at the name of the bill, the Homeland Battlefield Bill. It has a kind of ring to it that any totalitarian would love. Because it says not only must we fight the enemies abroad, we must fight the enemies at home. History has proven that once you strip marginal groups of their rights, soon everyone gets stripped of their rights.
So tell me what your analysis, what you think is going on here in America in a broader sense, what this represents. I mean, this is no matter where this case goes and whether you're allowed to be termed, was it a credible...
Whether I have standing is
standing,
the legal
standing.
Term.
Standing. Whether you have standing. What's beneath that? What's the subtext to what you think is happening here in this country that allows those kind of laws to be passed, and what we're facing, like the show we're doing tomorrow with Jeff Clements about a corporation is not a person. So what do you think? Talk about some of the subtext of all this.
Well, we've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, a corporate coup. We live in a system that the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin describes as inverted totalitarianism. And by that he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but in the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a charismatic figure and a sort of reactionary or revolutionary party that overthrows its structure and replaces it. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized the levers of power as to render the citizenry impotent. And that's precisely what's happened. Every piece of legislation that gets rammed through is written by corporate lobbyists, whether it's Obamacare, which ends up being 2,000 pages written by the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry with $400 billion in subsidies, whether it's the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of Americans. That's what's happening. We are, you know, and totalitarian societies always rewrite the legal code first. And unfortunately, we're very far down that process. And in times of instability, in times of turmoil, we have handed to the state the power to essentially rule with under martial law.
And you said you just said we're very far down that road. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, we've already passed the National Defense Authorization Act. I mean, the interesting thing about the National Defense Authorization Act is that most of the activities that it codifies have already been practiced by both the Bush and Obama administrations through a kind of radical interpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act. So we have had U.S. citizens. Jose Padilla, who allegedly was one of the hijackers that didn't make it on a plane, is held for 3.5 years in a military brig without due process, without access to counsel. This is challenged. It makes its way to the Supreme Court. Before the Supreme Court hears it, Padilla is transferred to a civilian court. The Supreme Court refuses to take the case, saying that because of that transfer, it's now moot. We have seen the 2001 Act used by the Obama White House to justify serving as judge, jury, and executioner for the Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike, a U.S. citizen. What the NDAA does, and the reason why it's so dangerous, is that there's no ambiguity left. In Section 1022 of the bill, it says that the president has the right to essentially, in the name of national security, declare an American citizen an enemy combatant and deny them of any legal protection due process. I mean, this is the language is stark and Orwellian and frightening.
Chris Hedges is with us, author, journalist, spent over 20 years as a nearly 20 years as a foreign correspondent covering wars in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, the Balkans. Worked for the New York Times, many of the newspapers. He's written numerous books. He joins us here in the studio tonight. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock at Falvey Hall at MICA, 1301 West Monument, West Mount Royal Street, 410-319-8888. Join the conversation. Your thoughts on what you're hearing. We'd love to have you into this dialogue with Chris Hedges at 410-319-8888. One of the things that you alluded to here, but I've heard you speak about before in public, is that you lay a lot of this as not just at the conservative doorstep, but you lay a lot of this at the liberal doorstep, that you find them as vacuous, vacant, and as dangerous as the other.
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is. And I wrote a 200-page book on it called Death of the Liberal Class.
You did.
Which sought to answer that question. What happened? Now, the liberal class in any society is vital for a democracy, but it's never designed to be the political left. The political left is inhabited by radical and populist movements in a functioning democracy. The Wobblies, the old CIO, even the Communist Party. The liberal class is the safety valve so that when you have a breakdown, when you have legitimate grievances, when you have widespread unemployment and injustice, for instance, during the New Deal, the liberal class functions to make incremental or piecemeal reform possible, which is what the New Deal was. And when Conrad Black writes his biography of FDR, he said that, and I think correctly, that FDR's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. Well, what happened to the liberal class is that these radical movements on the eve of World War I, were achieving tremendous political power. Eugene Debs, 1912, socialist candidate, runs for president, received 6% of the vote, 900,000 votes.
While he was in prison.
I don't think he was in prison.
It was the next election.
He ran five times.
He did run from in prison, but
1912 he wasn't in prison yet.
Right.
And Wilson, who won the 1912 election, had run on the platform, he kept us out of the war. The World War One had no popular support at all. But what happened with the collapse of Tsarist Russia was there was the very real possibility that the German war machine could transfer 100 divisions over to the Western Front. And if the British and the French were defeated, the huge bank loans that Wall Street had given to the British and the French would not be repaid. So there suddenly became tremendous pressure within the financial community for Wilson to enter the war. This was aided by the Kaiser's disastrous attempt to impose a naval blockade on Britain, which sank, I think, two or three American ships. So when Wilson announced our entry into the war, he realized that there was widespread revulsion for the war, deep pacifist and anti-war sentiment. And through Walter Lippmann, who I think is this kind of dark, grand inquisitor type of figure in American history, he sets up the Committee for Public Information, popularly known as the Creel Commission, which employs the understanding of crowd or mass psychology pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, and of course Sigmund Freud. And one of the architects of the modern public relations industry, who works ends up working for the CIA, Edward Bernays, who's Freud's nephew twice over through marriage, comes out of the Creel Commission. And not only can they employ the resources of government, they had its own film division. They used to make movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin. They had speakers bureaus, 45,000 speakers fanning out across the country. They had their own news division, which pumped out daily news, pro-war news stories that every publication, and the press was far more diversified than it is now, was forced to print. If you did not have a pro-war editorial stance, you could not publish. So you had publications like Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal with the fourth highest circulation in the country. Mm. The masses shuts down. And when you read the writings of radicals like Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, one of the things they despair of is how effective this system of propaganda is, because it employs that tug on emotion. It understands that people are not moved by reason or fact, but by the manipulation of emotion, or what Lippmann calls the manufacturing of consent. And so it's used by the power elite not only to foster widespread support for the war, but to turn on these radical groups that on the eve of the war, when we had over three dozen socialist mayors in this country, had been gaining ground against the robber baron and capitalist class. And then after the war, you know, instantly the dreaded Hun became the dreaded Red. We entered what the writer Dwight MacDonald calls the psychosis of permanent war. And MacDonald points out correctly that that World War I was the rock on which these radical populist progressive movements broke. He says that no social theorist in the 19th century, including Marx, grappled with the concept of permanent war, i.e. that search for internal as well as external enemies. You saw all of the thousands of people who had been in the Creel Commission, or Committee for Public Information, which, by the way, was very closely studied by Goebbels when he built the Nazi propaganda machine, migrate to Madison Avenue and start working for corporations. And, of course, what they did was to eradicate American culture, issues of, you know, values of thrift and self-effacement and sort of instill consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. They began to foster this kind of cult of the self. And we talk about American culture, but I think what we're really talking about today is corporate instilled culture. And after the war, they decimated these radical groups, the old Wobblies, Joe Hill, you know, trumped up murder charges, executed in Utah, Big Bill Haywood, also trumped up murder charges, flees the country, spends the last 10 years of his life in exile in Moscow. the crushing of these radical movements was accompanied by a disemboweling of liberal institutions. So you not only broke those radical and populist movements, which kept the liberal class honest, which put pressure on the liberal class from the left. And let's remember that all correctives to American democracy came through these movements.
And when you say liberal class, you're talking about, to be clear, for people listening right now, you're not about masses of people. You're talking about liberal class of the kind of elite classes who are part of the kind of ruling structure of America, when you call the liberal class.
Right. I'm talking about Roosevelt, his vice president, right. Henry Wallace, these kinds of figures. And so you had, a destruction of the popular movements, culminating with the Palmer Raids, but the end was, of course, after World War II with the McCarthy hearings, mm-hmm. when thousands of university professors, high school teachers, social workers, artists, directors, journalists like I.F. Stone, become pariahs in the name of the war, against communism. So even I.F. Stone can't get a job. He at the Nation magazine, even. And he ends up printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. And so what happened is that the impediments by which the average person was able to halt this kind of neo-feudalistic society, and essentially, let's be clear, I mean, labor unions in this country created the middle class. All these impediments were lifted. The radical movements were broken, and the liberal institutions were disemboweled from the inside. So that with the rise of the 1970s, essentially, and since then, it's just we have rolled back every gain made under the New Deal, whether it is the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, the gutting of welfare, the destruction, the assaults against basic social services, public education. I mean, it's a kind of endless list. And corporations have essentially been allowed to transfer their manufacturing processes overseas, so that by the early 1970s, we shifted, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. In essence, we began to borrow to maintain both a lifestyle and an empire we could no longer afford.
410-319-8888. Chris Hedges is with us in the studio here. I want to. There's so much you said, and there's the pieces I want to get to of your writing that I think is important for us to put on the table here before we can wind out an hour. But that. So one of the things I get from reading a lot of what you write, not everything, but these kinds of things that you've been writing, and I've read, I guess, seven of your books, is that it's a fairly dystopian view of where we're headed, of what we could be facing in the world, when you kind of talk about the power of what you see as the Occupy movement or other things going on in this country, and so I'm curious what your thoughts are about what response to all that is from your perspective.
Well, I was a war correspondent for a long time.
A long time.
And we never used the word optimistic or pessimistic. You figured out what the weapons systems were as best you could at the end of that road, and then you acted accordingly. People who had a kind of Pollyannish view or believed that somehow they were immortal usually didn't live too long in war zones.
Right.
So I'm not really interested in those terms. I'm interested in what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Unfettered, unregulated capitalism, as Karl Marx understood, is a revolutionary force because it commodifies everything. Human mm-hmm. labor becomes a commodity and the natural world becomes a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And that is why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. We have known about global warming since the 1970s. And if there is one single issue that mocks the whole idea of us as a rational species, it is the fact that we have not responded to global warming. In fact, of course, things are worse. And the entire planet is going out of whack. This winter, there was virtually no snow in the Northeast. We are seeing, even before the advent of spring, temperatures soaring into the 80s, freak weather patterns, and yet we're sort of blithely rolling along as if it's not happening. We retreat into two fantasy-based visions. One, of course, is that global warming doesn't exist, but the other, which is just as pernicious, is that somehow we can adapt. well, we'll just plant palm trees in Chicago or something. It's truly terrifying. And it's all done for quarterly profits. The fossil fuel industry determines our energy policy. These people don't see beyond their own personal enrichment at our expense. And that is the problem, that when essentially these corporate forces govern not only your economy but your political system, they are quite willing to sacrifice not only the ecosystem on which the human species depends for life, but the human species itself. And that's the state that we're in. The Republicans are as culpable in this as the Democrats. On all of the major structural issues, there is no difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. The only hope we have left is through acts of civil disobedience, and that's why I was such a fervent supporter of the Occupy movement, because they got it. They recognized that the issue was the corporate state, that everything sprang from corporate control, whether it's over healthcare, whether it's over education, whether it's over energy, whatever it is, that until we break the back of the corporate state, we are locked into this kind of death embrace. And frankly, you know, if you read Hansen and other climate scientists, we have very, very little time left.
Chris Hedges is with us. We're going to have a very brief break and come right back for a conversation. We'd like to hear your thoughts on whether or not you agree or disagree with what Chris is saying. No difference between Republicans and Democrats. Corporate control of America. Where are we headed? 410-319-8888. Come to call us in just a second. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Chris Hedges, Truth Dig columnist, writer of 9 books, Death of the Liberal Class, we were just talking about a moment ago. He spent almost 20 years as a foreign correspondent covering wars throughout the world. He'll be here tonight speaking at MICA at Falvey Hall at 7 p.m., 1301 West Mount Royal Avenue. It's free and open to the public. You should go join him there. Number here is 410-319-8888 is number here. Jay, we're going to come to your call, and the other's coming in, so hold on. I just want to ask this. Just something I have to ask you, given some of the stuff I've been reading, and your years of covering war, whether it's been in Gaza or El Salvador, throughout the world, the Balkans, and you've written some very touching stuff recently about what those experiences have done to you. And we spend a lot of time here, just you don't know this, I'm just telling you, we spend a lot of time here on the show talking about war, a lot of veterans of war, people who've been through it, and just to kind of put this on the table for people who've never experienced war to understand what it is and what people go through. But clearly, these 20 years or so of covering wars deeply affected you, changed you, turned you from this kind of almost establishment journalist into a new human being. Talk a bit about that sojourn for you and what you're trying to say to us about war.
Well, the only people who understand war are the people who go there, because the images and narratives that come out of war zones are so heavily censored and sanitized and repackaged around the hometown hero and glory and honor and courage and all the things that they do in movies like Restrepo and Sebastian Younger. And that's propaganda. It's garbage. And anybody who comes back and speaks honestly about the experience will tell you so. So I think, like many people who come back from combat, I've struggled to challenge the myth about war, the myth that is sold to us by the entertainment industry, by government, by educational systems, that somehow war is a maker of men, that war is, a noble enterprise, and yet it's extremely difficult. That myth is very, very powerful, and I think one of the crises that combat veterans come back and face when they have the capacity for self-reflection and for self-discovery is that they've been lied to by every institution, whether it's the church or schools. And there's a kind of, you know, existential crisis because they grasp that not only is war not sort of noble or heroic, but we are not a great nation blessed by virtue. Victory is not assured. We are as capable of committing evil as those we oppose. I mean, these are really difficult things for the wider public to hear, which is why I think so many people who come back from war just finally stop talking about it, because it's too painful and because they realize that most people don't want to hear it. So much of the myth of war is really at its core about self-exaltation. I mean, when we look at how war is covered on the cable news channels, it's retired military colonels or generals talking about the power of our weapons systems, and of course the unsort of spoken message is by extension our own power. I wrote a book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I'd never want to go through that experience again. When you spend as long as I did in war, you of course bear the scars of trauma. It's inevitable. And it's always painful and difficult to dredge it up. As far as my own sort of transformation, I actually don't think that it was quite as radical as it looks from the outside, because I always, as a reporter, threw myself into places like El Salvador, like Nicaragua, like Gaza, like the Sudan, like Yemen, Algeria, Sarajevo, Kosovo, because I wanted to tell the stories of people, and in particular civilians, who are being crushed by brutal military power. When I got to El Salvador in 1983, the death squads were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month. And this was very dangerous work. I mean, numerous colleagues and friends were killed, 22 in El Salvador, 45 foreign correspondents were killed in Sarajevo. I lost my closest friend, Kurt Schork. He was killed in Sierra Leone. And those of us who were not compliant reporters, those of us who didn't sort of print the embassy handouts or go to the State Department or the White House for briefings, were from the beginning targets. And this was true under every administration. I mean, when I did not report the narrative that Dick Holbrooke and Bill Clinton and Sandy Berger wanted reported out of Sarajevo, it got very, very nasty. I mean, they have ways of reaching your publisher and your editors and discrediting your work. So there was a kind of always antagonistic relationship, not only to power, but to your own Washington bureau, because these are people who make their living by doing lunch, which is why most of the Washington press corps is physically indistinguishable from the sort of Congress people and power elite State Department officials that they cover. Newspapers or news organizations need war reporters. And the attributes that make a good war reporter, which is a constant defiance of authority, because remember, the Serbs were telling us if we went into Sarajevo, they'd kill us. I mean, they did kill a lot of us, but we went anyway. We never fit back into the newsroom. So my problems with the New York Times came when I, essentially after the war in Kosovo, was really had lost the kind of physical and emotional resiliency of youth and was no longer able to carry out war. Then my problems came because our personality types are just not integrated into these news organizations, which is why none of us ever, if we try and come back, none of us ever last.
Like many men or women who fought or went through a war don't fit in when they come back either, in the world they're supposed to fit into.
Yes. Part of it is you see through all the trivia and inanity and lies. But also I think because the characteristics that go into making someone a good soldier, Marine, or war correspondent are characteristics that make you a pariah within a corporate structure. Because basically you're not very good at doing what you're told.
I do want to get the phones here. That's just one quick thing, though, just to conclude this part of our conversation. There was at the end, I think it was the end of the piece I read, Murder is Not an Anomaly in War, and you talked about your friend who was killed in Sierra Leone, who you just mentioned. You talked about war as an addiction, what happens to you. one of the only ways you can survive in it is to make it an addiction, to allow it to consume you.
I don't think you have a choice. I think when you spend long enough in war, it is an addiction. It's the most powerful narcotic invented by humankind, which is why war photographers and war journalists leap from war to war to war. So that in the war in Kosovo, I was covering it with two journalists who I had covered the war with 20 years before in El Salvador. It's you spend long enough in that environment, you can't fit in anywhere else. You return to sort of peacetime, you know, normal society, and you miss the rush. Soldiers and Marines call it a combat high. It's very real. You miss that sort of deformed group of individuals who at least understand you. So much of your cachet, professional cachet, is caught up in being a war correspondent. It's very, very hard to break free. So that, you know, many of my colleagues, including Kurt Schork, who I mentioned, had pulled back, but they want to go back for one more hit. I mean, combat is zen. It is the most. You're present in ways that you never were before. Even colors are brighter. You can replicate every synthetic drug trip known to humankind on a battlefield, whether it's the hallucinogenic visions of, you know, landscapes in Sarajevo after being obliterated by Katyusha rockets and 155 howitzers, whether it's the kind of zombie-like hashish fog of never sleeping for days on end, whether it's the zip of fear and adrenaline, it's all there.
So how does that affect Chris Hedges now? What is that? What I was trying to get to earlier also was how that, in some senses, fuels your intellectual approach now, your political approach now, your approach to what you're saying about where we live now.
Well, when you are in war, all the sort of facades, the nice facades that liberals believe in, human kindness and human sweetness, it's all stripped down in places like the Balkans. If you were sitting, as I was, in a basement in Sarajevo when it was getting stonked with 2,000 shells a day, constant sniper fire, 4 to 5 dead a day, about 2 dozen wounded a day, you know, bringing up a discussion of pacifism would have evoked gales of laughter. We knew that if the Serbs broke through the trench systems and the city was ringed by trench systems for 3.5 years, a third of the city would be slaughtered and the rest would be driven into displacement and refugee camps, because that's what happened in the Drina Valley and it's what happened in Vukovar. So all of the sort of, the fantasies that are embraced by people who live in secure comfort within these kind of industrialized zones of wealth and privilege are shattered. And you see the dark side of human nature. You see what human beings are capable of doing.
At the same time, because, folks, I apologize, I'm going to go to these calls, but at the same time, you write these other pieces about love and the power of love to transform, what that does even in the middle of war. You wrote about that in terms of Gaza. You write about that in terms of the writer whose name I'm blocking on now, who wrote about the Poles who helped some of the Jews, you know, during the war. So that's another piece that, because of all this, that has spoken to you, and you're talking about it in terms of how we have to begin to respond.
Yes, but love is real, and so is death. And when you are caught up in a war zone, you see these two forces; they become almost physically palpable. So that when heavy shells would come into a marketplace in Sarajevo, you know, ripping apart human bodies, people having their legs blown off or their entrails out, bleeding to death on the cobblestones, images that, by the way, were never transmitted over the television screens. You saw, you know, brief glimpses and sanitized glimpses at that. You at the same time, you would have people tearing through the crowds searching for loved ones, and you could feel radiating outwards, these concentric circles of love and death, love and death. Now, that doesn't mean that you as a distinct individual will survive. But you see, for those who, in the midst of war, and at its essence, of course, war is about death. It is about the extinguishing of all systems of life, political, economic, social, familial. You see these remarkable individuals, Oscar Romero and others, who just stand up. and the truth that they speak, and the capacity to speak that truth without fear, and to affirm what we all must affirm, has an undeniable power. And that is the real battle. I mean, Vasily Grossman, in his great epic novel Life and Fate, gets it, that it's it's about the power of human kindness, and the more stupid and blind and helpless that kindness is, the more vast and potent it becomes, because totalitarian systems essentially seek to break that human solidarity, and yet they never have been able to break it.
Chris Hedges is our guest. We will go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Chris, I may shut down those headphones just for a minute so you can hear the folks calling in. 410-319-8888. And Jay in Middle River, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, Jay, welcome. Thank you.
I think you painted a grim but courageous picture of you on politics and its influence on constituencies of all kinds. Do you think that media, particularly social networking, has kind of watered that potency down of affecting people, because now those back rooms are a little bit smaller and people have more of an opportunity to mobilize through grassroots means? And my other question is, do you think that your message, because of the experiences you've had and the things that you've seen, would be readily translatable to people who have not been in combat or war, to be able to apply those to political and ideological thinking? And I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you.
Well, social media is useful as a tool for communication. It's not particularly useful as a tool for organization or mobilization. That can only be done in the street. And we saw that with the Occupy movement, which is why the state moved in to physically eradicate those encampments, because they became, in essence, sort of town halls, places where people could discuss issues, and the power elite was very frightened of it. In terms of war, I think for those of us who have spent large chunks of our lives on the outer reaches of empire, we have a vision of who we are and what empire is that those who remain in the heart of empire just do not have. And I think that it's very difficult, even for people who may be critics of empire, to hear what it is we have to say. I can remember a dinner at Princeton where I taught with other professors who were defending the occupation of Afghanistan because we were liberating women in Afghanistan. Now, if you've been in a war zone and you've seen the explosive power of Hellfire missiles, TOW missiles, cruise missiles, tank rounds, belt-fed saw machine guns, any talk of human rights is an absurdity. We kill children every single day, almost every day in Afghanistan. We just never stop and count the bodies. And that is something that even well-meaning liberals, because I think that, in the heart of empire, they're blinded, can't see and can't understand.
Yeah, I think, let me go back to the phones, because that is something that's difficult for people to put their hands around, because they don't see it. I'm not even sure what would happen if they were allowed to graphically see it every day on the web or on the news, if that would begin to change consciousness. We stopped glossing it over and painting these pictures of what war really was and just showing our brave men kind of coming back wounded and the rest. I don't know if that would have something that would hit consciousness. Maybe it would not.
Well, we have the capacity to show war. When you have your legs blown off, I've seen it twice, by an anti-tank mine, it takes you 6 hours to bleed to death. We could in real time set up a feed, and for 6 hours you could watch that person bleed to death. But that isn't going to happen, because if you saw what war is, it would be so repulsive and disconcerting, it would be hard to wage it.
410-319-8888. Another Jay, this time in Annapolis. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi,
Mr. Hedges, thank you so much for all of your tremendous reporting and telling it like it is. It's greatly appreciated by a lot of us out here. I know that you had filed a lawsuit against President Obama, and I was just curious if you could kind of go over the status of that situation and where you think that might actually lead. And the other question I wanted to ask was, are you surprised at all that the Defense Authorization Act and the Patriot Act have gone unchallenged by the Supreme Court this long in terms of their constitutionality or their lack thereof?
First of all, I did a four-hour deposition with the government on Friday, and we go to court at 9 a.m. at the Southern District Court in New York. If I am ruled to be a credible plaintiff in legal terms, if I have standing, then the lawyers will, Carl Mayer and Bruce Safran, will immediately file a temporary injunction, which will hold the law in abeyance. Of course, the government will challenge that. And we could very well reach the Supreme Court. Given the composition of the court, I mean, I think we have to be pretty clear. I'm not terribly optimistic. And I think the composition of the court, especially looking at some of the most egregious decisions, including the 2010 Citizens United, shows whose side they're on, and it's not our side. So I'm not particularly surprised that it has gone unchallenged, although it's clearly unconstitutional.
So when you when you write what you're writing today, and when you speak around the country, and the work you're doing now, which I love with Joe Sacco, trying to get, in some ways, reach a broader audience with graphic depictions of what's going on. I'm curious when you what you see coming out of the movements that are protesting America now, whether it's the Occupy movements. And you've critiqued some of the anarchists in those Occupy movements as well for what they're doing there.
Well, not anarchists, Black Bloc. I don't have any problem with anarchists.
You're right. Excuse me. Let me speak correctly. Or whether it's the groups that are organizing now around the murder of Trayvon Martin. I mean, I'm curious what you see in the face of the onslaught of this, of the corporate power that we face. What do you think those movements amount to?
Well, the movements aren't going away. Movements, and I've covered them, have a kind of life of their own, a kind of centrifugal force. Even the purported leaders of these movements don't know where they're going, and I've covered many of them, all of the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the two Palestinian uprisings. You have all these sort of Lutheran ministers, 100 of them or 70 of them marching around Leipzig with candlelight vigils, and then suddenly there's 70,000 of them. What is it that brings people into the street? How do you move from there to 500,000 people, which is what happened, converging on Alexanderplatz early November of 1989, the largest demonstration against communist rule since the end of World War II? You don't know. I think that the state has shown its hand. By physically trying to erase the encampments. It has nothing to offer other than force and the security and surveillance state. It is not going to address the fundamental issues that pushed people into these encampments and pushed people to support these movements, which would, at its minimum, include a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiving of the $1 trillion in student debt, a massive jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25. This would be the minimum. This would be the kind of New Deal policy that might be able to save capitalism. But the corporate state is so myopic, so blind, and so out of touch. They no longer live in America. They are utterly disconnected from normal American lives. They have retreated into gated compounds like the Forbidden City or Versailles, and that disconnect will kill them because they only know one word, which is more. And they are harvesting, it's a business term, the entire country. They know nothing's left. They're just trying to grab everything that remains, which is why they want the roughly $600 billion the government spends on education. They want it. Anytime hedge fund managers take a fervent interest in inner city schools, it's not because they care about education. I think the elite is so corrupt and so rotten and so bankrupt that it is – and because they have not responded to the very legitimate grievances and pain that is being visited on larger and larger numbers of Americans, and not only in the underclass, but increasingly in the middle class, that something seismic happened on September 17th. And it's not going to go away. But what will it look like a few months from now, a year from now? No one knows. And I can say that with certainty because I have watched movements as they more. I covered the Velvet Revolution. I was in the Magic Lantern Theater every night with Václav Havel. Václav Havel didn't know. Klaus didn't know. No one knows.
So you talk about capitalism, and I wonder, do you think capitalism can be saved? Do you think it should be saved? I mean, we look back at what Roosevelt did, in fact, save this country, save capitalism from itself in many ways.
Yes.
And those 30 years, this 40 years, whatever it was, from the 30s to the 70s were this kind of, in quotes, golden age where things grew and people began desegregation and people had jobs and built industry and the middle class was built. But that seems like an anomaly, like a blip.
Well, that's right. And it's not coming back. And we are going to have to reconfigure how we relate to each other, how we relate to the ecosystem, how we relate to the rest of the world if we are going to survive. And, of course, we're not doing that. We're entranced with these virtual hallucinations, pounded with trivia and celebrity gossip, the leeching of sort of entertainment into news. I don't know who's the latest, Kim Kardashian. I mean, I can't even keep track of these morons and what they're doing. But it's always something. And that's what happens with dying civilizations. If you go back and look at...
You think we're a dying civilization.
Yeah. I mean, go back and look at the end of the Roman Empire. And Cicero's writing about how the emotional and intellectual life of Rome was caught up in the arena, in the spectacle. That's how you end up with a Nero or a Caligula or a George W. Bush. Look at the end of the Ottoman Empire. Look at the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Joseph Roth writes about it in Radetzky March and Savoy Hotel. There is a kind of willful checking out of reality, partly because reality is so difficult to face. And then that becomes very dangerous because it perpetuates a kind of infantilism where nobody ever has to grow up. And as that gap opens up between who we think we are and where we think we're going and the reality, when that illusion implodes. We're unprepared psychologically, emotionally, and we do what all children do, which is reach out for a demagogue or savior who promises new glory and new moral renewal, and then we're finished.
Chris Hedges, you're always a wake-up call. I appreciate you coming in the studio here before your talk tonight at MICA.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much. Chris will be at MICA tonight, 7 p.m., following the show at Falvey Hall, 1301 West Mount Royal Avenue. So listen to us for the next hour. Head on down to MICA and join Chris Hedges. You can hear him speak. I'm sure there'll be a lively interaction as well when he finishes. And Chris, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We come back from this very brief break. We're going to look at Trayvon's murder and more with some really interesting guests who have different perspectives on this. One who just wrote in. We'll see if we can get her on as well. Stay with us.